Chapter 3. Counting houses that the risks were too great, and that only one more trip could be made. After giving in the usual way many misleading hints as to our destination, we slipped away quietly, and after a very quick passage entered the bay. It was early morning, and even before the anchor went to the bottom the schooner was surrounded by boats. The first thing we heard was that Karain's mysterious sword-bearer had died a few days ago. We did not attach much importance to the news. It was certainly difficult to imagine Karain without his inseparable follower. But the fellow was old, he had never spoken to one of us, we hardly ever had heard the sound of his voice, and we had come to look upon him as upon something inanimate, as a part of our friend's trappings of state, like that sword he had carried, or the fringed red umbrella displayed during an official progress. Karain did not visit us in the afternoon as usual. A message of greeting and a present of fruit and vegetables came off for us before sunset. Our friend paid us like a banker, but treated us like a prince. We sat up for him till midnight. Under the stern awning, bearded Jackson jingled an old guitar and sang, with an execrable accent, Spanish love songs, while young Hollis and I, sprawling on the deck, had a game of chess by the light of a cargo lantern. Karain did not appear. Next day we were busy unloading, and heard that the Raja was unwell. The expected invitation to visit him ashore did not come. We sent friendly messages, but, fearing to intrude upon some secret council, remained on board. Early on the third day we had landed all the powder and rifles, and also a 6-pounder brass gun with its carriage, which we had subscribed together for a present for our friend. The afternoon was sultry. Ragged edges of black clouds peeped over the hills, and invisible thunderstorms circled outside, growling like wild beasts. We got the schooner ready for sea, intending to leave next morning at daylight. All day a merciless sun blazed down into the bay, fierce and pale, as if at white heat. Nothing moved on the land. The beach was empty, the villages seemed deserted. The trees far off stood in unstirring clumps, as if painted. The white smoke of some invisible bushfire spread itself low over the shores of the bay like a settling fog. Late in the day, three of Karain's chief men, dressed in their best, and armed to the teeth, came off in a canoe, bringing a case of dollars. They were gloomy and languid, and told us they had not seen their Raja for 5 days. No one had seen him. We settled all accounts, and after shaking hands in turn and in profound silence, they descended one after another into their boat, and were paddled to the shore, sitting close together, clad in vivid colors, with hanging heads. The gold embroideries of their jackets flashed dazzlingly as they went away gliding on the smooth water, and not one of them looked back once. Before sunset the growling clouds carried with a rush the ridge of hills, and came tumbling down the inner slopes. Everything disappeared. Black whirling vapors filled the bay, and in the midst of them the schooner swung here and there in the shifting gusts of wind. A single clap of thunder detonated in the hollow with a violence that seemed capable of bursting into small pieces the ring of high land, and a warm deluge descended. The wind died out. We panted in the close cabin. Our faces streamed. The bay outside hissed as if boiling. The water fell in perpendicular shafts as heavy as lead. It swished about the deck, poured off the spars, gurgled, sobbed, splashed, murmured in the blind night. Our lamp burned low. Hollis, stripped to the waist, lay stretched out on the lockers, with closed eyes and motionless like a despoiled corpse. At his head Jackson twanged the guitar, and gasped out in sighs a mournful dirge about hopeless love and eyes like stars. Then we heard startled voices on deck crying in the rain, hurried footsteps overhead, and suddenly Karain appeared in the doorway of the cabin. His bare breast and his face glistened in the light. His sarong, soaked, clung about his legs. He had his sheathed kris in his left hand, and wisps of wet hair, escaping from under his red kerchief, stuck over his eyes and down his cheeks. He stepped in with a headlong stride and looking over his shoulder like a man pursued. Hollis turned on his side quickly and opened his eyes. Jackson clapped his big hand over the strings, and the jingling vibration died suddenly. I stood up. "We did not hear your boat's hail," I exclaimed. "Boat." The man swum off, drawled out Hollis from the locker. "Look at him." He breathed heavily, wild-eyed, while we looked at him in silence. Water dripped from him, made a dark pool, and ran crookedly across the cabin floor. We could hear Jackson, who had gone out to drive away our Malay seaman from the doorway of the companion. He swore menacingly in the patter of a heavy shower, and there was a great commotion on deck. The watchmen, scared out of their wits by the glimpse of a shadowy figure leaping over the rail, straight out of the night as it were, had alarmed all hands. Then Jackson, with glittering drops of water on his hair and beard, came back looking angry, and Hollis, who, being the youngest of us, assumed an indolent superiority, said without stirring, "Give him a dry sarong, give him mine. It's hanging up in the bathroom." Karen laid the kris on the table, hilt inwards, and murmured a few words in a strangled voice. "What's that?" asked Hollis, who had not heard. "He apologizes for coming in with a weapon in his hand," I said, dazedly. "Ceremonious beggar. Tell him we forgive a friend. Dot dot on such a night," drawled out Hollis. "W what's wrong?" Karen slipped the dry sarong over his head, dropped the wet one at his feet, and stepped out of it. I pointed to the wooden armchair, his armchair. He sat down very straight, said, "Hey," in a strong voice. A short shiver shook his broad frame. He looked over his shoulder uneasily, turned as if to speak to us, but only stared in a curious blind manner, and again looked back. Jackson bellowed out, "Watch well on deck there." Heard a faint answer from above, and reaching out with his foot slammed to the cabin door. "All right now," he said. Karen's lips moved slightly. A vivid flash of lightning made the two round stern ports facing him glimmer like a pair of cruel and phosphorescent eyes. The flame of the lamp seemed to wither into brown dust for an instant, and the looking glass over the little sideboard leaped out behind his back in a smooth sheet of livid light. The roll of thunder came near, crashed over us, the schooner trembled, and the great voice went on, threatening terribly, into the distance. For less than a minute a furious shower rattled on the decks. Karen looked slowly from face to face, and then the silence became so profound that we all could hear distinctly the two chronometers in my cabin ticking along with unflagging speed against one another. And we three, strangely moved, could not take our eyes from him. He had become enigmatical and touching, in virtue of that mysterious cause that had driven him through the night and through the thunderstorm to the shelter of the schooner's cuddy. Not one of us doubted that we were looking at a fugitive, incredible as it appeared to us. He was haggard, as though he had not slept for weeks. He had become lean, as though he had not eaten for days. His cheeks were hollow, his eyes sunk, the muscles of his chest and arms twitched slightly, as if after an exhausting contest. Of course it had been a long swim off to the schooner, but his face showed another kind of fatigue, the tormented weariness, the anger and the fear of a struggle against a thought, an idea against something that cannot be grappled, that never rests a shadow, a nothing, unconquerable and immortal, that preys upon life. We knew it, as though he had shouted it at us. His chest expanded time after time, as if it could not contain the beating of his heart. For a moment he had the power of the possessed, the power to awaken in the beholder's wonder, pain, pity, and a fearful near sense of things invisible, of things dark and mute, that surround the loneliness of mankind. His eyes roamed about aimlessly for a moment, then became still. He said with effort, "I came here. Dot dot I leaped out of my stockade, as after a defeat. I ran in the night. The water was black. I left him calling on the edge of black water. Dot 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 I left him standing alone on the beach. I swam. Dot dot he called out after me. Dot 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 I swam. Dot dot." He trembled from head to foot, sitting very upright and gazing straight before him. Left whom? Who called? We did not know. We could not understand. I said at all hazards, be firm. The sound of my voice seemed to steady him into a sudden rigidity, but otherwise he took no notice. He seemed to listen, to expect something for a moment, then went on, he cannot come here, therefore I sought you. You men with white faces who despise the invisible voices. He cannot abide your unbelief and your strength. He was silent for a while, then exclaimed softly, oh, the strength of unbelievers. There's no one here, but you and we three, said Hollis, quietly. He reclined with his head supported on elbow, and did not budge. I know, said Karain. He has never followed me here. Was not the wise man ever by my side? But since the old wise man, who knew of my trouble, has died, I have heard the voice every night. I shut myself up for many days in the dark. I can hear the sorrowful murmurs of women, the whisper of the wind, of the running waters, the clash of weapons in the hands of faithful men, their footsteps and his voice. So. In my ear. I felt him near. His breath passed over my neck. I leaped out without a cry. All about me men slept quietly. I ran to the sea. He ran by my side without footsteps, whispering old words, whispering into my ear in his old voice. I ran into the sea. I swam off to you, with my kris between my teeth. I, armed, I fled before a breath to you. Take me away to your land. The wise old man has died, and with him is gone the power of his words and charms. And I can tell no one. No one. There is no one here faithful enough, and wise enough to know. It is only near you, unbelievers, that my trouble fades like a mist under the eye of day. He turned to me. With you I go, he cried in a contained voice. With you, who know so many of us. I want to leave this land, my people. And him there. He pointed a shaking finger at random over his shoulder. It was hard for us to bear the intensity of that undisclosed distress. Hollis stared at him hard. I asked gently, where is the danger? Everywhere outside this place, he answered, mournfully. I in every place where I am. He waits for me on the paths, under the trees, in the place where I sleep everywhere but here. He looked round the little cabin, at the painted beams, at the tarnished varnish of bulkheads. He looked round, as if appealing to all its shabby strangeness, to the disorderly jumble of unfamiliar things that belong to an inconceivable life of stress, of power, of endeavor, of unbelief, to the strong life of white men, which rolls on irresistible and hard on the edge of outer darkness. He stretched out his arms, as if to embrace it and us. We waited. The wind and rain had ceased, and the stillness of the night round the schooner was as dumb and complete as if a dead world had been laid to rest in a grave of clouds. We expected him to speak. The necessity within him tore at his lips. There are those who say that a native will not speak to a white man. Error. No man will speak to his master, but to a wanderer and a friend, to him who does not come to teach or to rule. To him who asks for nothing and accepts all things, words are spoken by the campfires, in the shared solitude of the sea, in riverside villages, in resting places surrounded by forests, words are spoken, that take no account of race or color. One heart speaks, another one listens, and the earth, the sea, the sky, the passing wind and the stirring leaf, hear also the futile tale of the burden of life. He spoke at last. It is impossible to convey the effect of his story. It is undying, it is but a memory, and its vividness cannot be made clear to another mind, any more than the vivid emotions of a dream. One must have seen his innate splendor, one must have known him before, looked at him then. The wavering gloom of the little cabin, the breathless stillness outside, through which only the lapping of water against the schooner's sides could be heard. Hollis's pale face, with steady dark eyes, the energetic head of Jackson held up between two big palms, and with the long yellow hair of his beard flowing over the strings of the guitar lying on the table, Karen's upright and motionless pose, his tone always made an impression that cannot be forgotten. He faced us across the table. His dark head and bronze torso appeared above the tarnished slab of wood, gleaming and still, as if cast in metal. Only his lips moved, and his eyes glowed, went out, blazed again, or stared mournfully. His expressions came straight from his tormented heart. His words sounded low, in a sad murmur, as of running water. At times they rang loud like the clash of a war gong, or trailed slowly like weary travelers, or rushed forward with the speed of fear. IV, this is, imperfectly, what he said. It was after the great trouble that broke the alliance of the four states of Weijo. We fought amongst ourselves, and the Dutch watched from afar till we were weary. Then the smoke of their fire ships was seen at the mouth of our rivers, and their great men came in boats full of soldiers, to talk to us of protection and peace. We answered with caution and wisdom, for our villages were burned, our stockades weak, the people weary, and the weapons blunt. They came and went. There had been much talk, but after they went away everything seemed to be as before, only their ships remained in sight from our coast, and very soon their traders came amongst us under a promise of safety. My brother was a ruler, and one of those who had given the promise. I was young then, and had fought in the war, and Padmatara had fought by my side. We had shared hunger, danger, fatigue, and victory. His eyes saw my danger quickly, and twice my arm had preserved his life. It was his destiny. He was my friend. And he was great amongst us, one of those who were near my brother, the ruler. He spoke in council, his courage was great, he was the chief of many villages, round the great lake, that is in the middle of our country as the heart is in the middle of a man's body. When his sword was carried into a campong in advance of his coming, the maidens whispered wonderingly under the fruit trees, the rich men consulted together in the shade, and a feast was made ready with rejoicing and songs. He had the favor of the ruler, and the affection of the poor. He loved war, deer hunts, and the charms of women. He was the possessor of jewels, of lucky weapons, and of men's devotion. He was a fierce man. And I had no other friend. I was the chief of a stockade at the mouth of the river, and collected tolls for my brother from the passing boats. One day I saw a Dutch trader go up the river. He went up with three boats, and no toll was demanded from him, because the smoke of Dutch warships stood out from the open sea, and we were too weak to forget treaties. He went up under the promise of safety, and my brother gave him protection. He said he came to trade. He listened to our voices, for we are men who speak openly and without fear. He counted the number of our spears. He examined the trees, the running waters, the grasses of the bank, the slopes of our hills. He went up to Matara's country and obtained permission to build a house. He traded and planted. He despised our joys, our thoughts, and our sorrows. His face was red, his hair like flame, and his eyes pale, like a river mist. He moved heavily, and spoke with a deep voice. He laughed aloud like a fool, and knew no courtesy in his speech. He was a big, scornful man, who looked into women's faces, and put his hand on the shoulders of free men, as though he had been a noble-born chief. We bore with him. Time passed. Then Padmatara's sister fled from the campong, and went to live in the Dutchman's house. She was a great and willful lady. I had seen her once carried high on slaves' shoulders amongst the people, with uncovered face, and I had heard all men say that her beauty was extreme, silencing the reason and ravishing the heart of the beholders. The people were dismayed. Matara's face was blackened with that disgrace, for she knew as he had been promised to another man. Matara went to the Dutchman's house, and said, "Give her up to die, she is the daughter of chiefs." The white man refused and shut. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.